Our special guest tonight, David Politis, as we talk about his work, Missing 411 Canada. That's the latest. Just came out today. We'll tell you how you can get that book in just a moment as well. We're going to talk more about what's going on in Canada now when we come back, and we'll also take your calls this hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with David Politis. David, I assume you were talking about Mount Seymour out there in British Columbia.
Yes, sir, I was. Step back for a second. When I did the book Missing 411 Hunters, where it was just a story of hunters who disappeared in the wild, one of the things that became apparent was there was something called the point of separation, where two hunters decide, hey, we're going to split up, we'll come back, we'll meet together later. When that happens, that's when something afterwards occurs. And it's not good normally. Someone disappears. Oftentimes, that point of separation occurs because one of the people doesn't feel well. And the first story right out of the chute involves a guy named Arthur Tibbett, November 9th, 1953, 29 years old, an RCAF veteran, lived with his wife and child in Deep Cove, British Columbia, and he was a technician for CBC Canada. On November 9th, he was working on the transmitter tower on Mount Seymour with a series of other technicians. They went to the lodge on the mountain. There was a ski area up there, with other technicians because he said he didn't feel well and he needed some aspirins. Well, he went down there, walked down there with the other guys, got some aspirins, and something happened. All of a sudden, they said, we didn't see him anymore. He was, like, gone. And they walked out to the parking lot. His car was still there.
Jeez.
He had about a 15-mile trip to his residence from the top of the mountain. At the end of the afternoon, when he didn't come home, his wife called the police. The technicians were already looking for him, and the RCMP found his car in the parking lot where the technician said it'd be. Well, that night, dozens of police responded, and they also sent a canine up there to try to track from the car. Now, the weird part is here is that the canine tracked from his car up to the top of one of the highest peaks in the area, and it just sat down. Well, friends described Arthur's pain as a splitting headache. And he couldn't work anymore. That's what he told his friends.
Is that unusual for some of these victims?
You know, it's variable. Some get headaches. Some get nauseous. Some feel real weak. But the commonality is they don't feel well.
Interesting.
And it's almost something drives them away that they have to go rest or do something. And I mean, it's readily apparent once you read the books that this is something's going on. Well, after a four-day search, they didn't find any of his tools. They didn't find him. They found nothing. And what I tell people about this case is, George, imagine if you had a splitting headache. The last thing you'd want to do is take a hike to a peak higher in elevation and get your pulse going and get your work going. It would just make the headache worse.
Exactly. I'd want to go lie down somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Well, since that time, the guesstimate has been probably 50 to 100,000 people have climbed that mountain since he went missing, and not one thing of Arthur Tibbett has ever been found.
That's weird.
So, then you go to November 14th, same month, November 1970, Michael Bryant. He was 32 years old. He was married with a young child, and he just landed a new engineering job in downtown Vancouver. On the 14th, he told his wife he was going to take an afternoon hike on Mount Seymour and he'd be back for dinner. After it got dark, his wife got concerned, called the RCMP. Police went up there, found his car in the same lodge parking lot. Formal search started the next day. And in the meantime, police that night interviewed his wife and found that her husband was going to hike to a location called Mystery Lake. Remember that name.
Okay.
And the next morning, a search and rescue was focused on that Mystery Lake area. And the wife said, yeah, he had done this hike before. He knew the area, and he just loved the hike and seeing the scenery. On November 21st, an article in the Vancouver Sun had a search and rescue commander saying that by the end of that day, they'd have 100% coverage of the primary search area. Now, I have never heard a SAR commander say 100%. But Michael's brother was a special prosecutor for the Ontario Commission of Water and got the BC government to keep searching for an additional 3 days. The search and rescue ended with the commander stating that it was the most frustrating search and rescue he'd ever ran. Nothing was ever found.
Gosh.
That's not the end of Mount Seymour. September 7th, 1987, 61-year-old Charlie Musso went up to Mount Seymour. He was an immigrant from Italy, regularly hiked the mountains. He was an insurance salesman, married for 22 years with a family and kids. He did exercises every morning, was in perfect condition. On September 7th, 87, it was a national holiday in Canada, and there were a lot of people on the mountain. At 7 a.m., he dropped his son at an event that was in Vancouver. He knew he had to pick his son up at 1:30, and he told his son he was going to hike Mount Seymour to an old trapper's cabin. Well, Carlo never made it back to pick up his son. His wife called the RCMP at 5 p.m. Police found his car in the same parking lot where all the others were. A massive search started the next day. Police found two groups of people who witnessed hearing cries for help 5 kilometers from the parking lot in the area of Dinky Peak, and this was 3 kilometers past Mystery Lake. The search consisted of RCMP dogs, 2 helicopters, 8 bloodhounds, search and rescue teams from several jurisdictions. He was a parishioner of a local St. Helens parish in Burnaby, and the father of the parish made a public plea for assistance. The search and rescue commander stated they were baffled because they couldn't find anything. Massive search never found Charlie Musso.
Jeez. And these cries for help, what did they hear? Just screams or help or anything specific?
I wish there was something more specific in the reports. It just said cries for help.
Cries for help. Okay.
Then you go November 14th, same month, November 1993, 29 years old, a UBC, University of British Columbia film school student, Stephen Eby. This one's a little weird. Moved to British Columbia the summer of 93 from Bozeman, Montana. Well, on the 14th of November, he drove his car from the UBC student lot and parked in the lodge parking lot on Mount Seymour. One witness reported seeing him 1/2 mile north of Mystery Lake. This area is surrounded by huge rock outcroppings and water. This time of the year, most of the water would have been frozen and cold. On November 16th, 2 days after he went to the mountain, a friend noticed that Steve's car was not in its normal place, notified Vancouver police, and asked them to check Mount Seymour. They went up, found the car on the 17th. His parents were notified in Montana and told the commanders that Stephen was a very, very experienced outdoorsman and knew how to handle himself in all conditions. 150 searchers from 9 jurisdictions aided in the search. There was fog and blizzard conditions that hindered the search for him. On November 18th, commanders told the press they had not found any tracks or anything indicating a presence of him in the area. 5-day search produced nothing, and the commanders were visibly frustrated. Now, here's the weird part. Nothing on this case for 2 months until January 7th, 1994. An article stated, authorities in Vancouver have identified the headless body found near Mount Seymour Provincial Park as Stephen Eby.
Headless?
A former resident of Bozeman, Montana. Corporal Howard Curry of the RCMP said the body was washed down Swift Creek and was badly battered. Curry said the cause of death has not been determined, but foul play is not suspected.
What?
That's exactly what I put in the book. Huh. What? So, the body was badly battered and headless. What else would the RCMP need to do to start an investigation?
Exactly.
So, George, I've probably read somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 search and rescue reports. I have never read a search and rescue report where they found a headless body where there wasn't a criminal element involved.
Badly battered.
Yes.
Jeez. That's weird.
You know there was never another statement about this case?
It's like they sweep these under the carpet.
Well, you think about it. So how many cases have I identified so far in Mount Seymour, and we're not done, and then they find a headless one, and you'd think somebody would be paying attention.
Yeah, this one sticks out like a sore thumb.
So, Carl Walter, June 28, 97, 5 p.m., Mount Seymour, 65 years old, a German immigrant, left his home the morning of June 28th in North Delta, headed for Mount Seymour for a hike. He parked his car at the trailhead and started his hike with his wife. 30 minutes into their hike, Mrs. Walter told her husband that she was too tired to continue and was going back to the car. So here's that point of separation. Mrs. Walter waited 9 hours at the car, then called RCMP and reported her husband as missing. RCMP arrived that first night, met with the wife. North Shore Search and Rescue was called. Starting the morning of June 29th, a massive search was started. Mr. Walter was not ready for an overnight journey, and he only had a small backpack with some food and water. For much of the 4 days, fog and rain hit the area and caused disruptions in the search. Rain was falling at lower elevations and snow at higher. Mrs. Walter told searchers that her husband had a rare disease that caused muscle spasms and unsteadiness. After 6 days of searching, Walter was never located, nor was his backpack or any of his clothes or shoes. That's the fifth case now on Mount Seymour. Now, of these five people that vanished on the mountain, I can guarantee that not all have vanished right there and could not be found. How could five people vanish on the same mountain and thousands have hiked that and nothing's been found?
Nothing. Nothing. And they're all men. Now, one could deduce that there were no women hikers, but it's still strange. It was all men.
So if you go just west of there, like 10 miles west, there's a location called Lynn Canyon, just north of North Vancouver, where two women disappeared within a mile of each other and were never found.
Well, that's weird.
One was 29-year-old Wendy Riley, and she was married to David Riley, and they had lived in Vancouver at one point. They were now living in Santa Rosa. They were on a vacation, a lengthy six-week vacation, went to their hometown of Toronto, and then they were stopping in Vancouver for a trip. Wendy dropped her husband in downtown Vancouver to meet with some friends, and she was going to meet back up with him later that night at a party. Well, when she didn't meet up at the party, David got concerned, started calling her phone. She never picked up. He called the RCMP that first night, and they found her car located in the Lynn Canyon parking lot. Inside the car, they found her purse with all of her credit cards, money, and all of her belongings. Now, I stopped there for a second. So, I know, because I've hiked with a lot of friends before, and women don't normally like to carry a purse when they're going on a hike.
Right, exactly.
So that makes sense to me. That
yeah.
She would put it in her car. So the RCMP put several search and rescue teams in the park to search for Wendy. It was raining so hard that they had to pull the teams out, and they stated that they found no evidence of a crime at the scene, no apparent struggle in or around the car. After several searches over 10 days, the RCMP stated, "This is a total mystery. It is entirely out of character for her to disappear like this." In March 1983, the RCMP put divers into Lynn Creek. They did find a coat that they thought might be Wendy's, and it was later confirmed that these were not hers, but it was weird that the RCMP made such a strong statement about this coat when they never even interviewed the husband about it. She was a college graduate, happily married, extremely stable, a bizarre disappearance. There's another disappearance in this exact area, also of a woman. Now, the reason I bring up the two women is that in my research, and this is odd, men disappear in one area and women disappear in another.
That's
when
strange.
You look at that cluster map, you're going to see that there's clusters of pink and clusters of dark. Pink are the women. It's a hard thing to figure out.
Now, British Columbia, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So the last disappearance I want to talk about is really a strange one. And this happened way up in northern British Columbia. Closest town would be Fort Nelson. Raymond Krieger, August 28, 92, 9 p.m. He's also German. Raymond was an experienced outdoorsman that loved hunting. In late August of 92, he was visiting friends in Fort Nelson and then joined his two hunting buddies by traveling into a place called Tushodi, T-U-C-H-O-D-I Lakes. The trio rode on horseback for 7 hours into this remote hunting camp. And the region is described by some people as some of the most remote and desolate in British Columbia. And that's saying something. Well, they arrived at about 9 p.m. The guys set up their tent, crawled into their tent, and they were getting ready to go to sleep. And everyone was exhausted. Friends said that Raymond was telling others he wasn't feeling well when he hit the tent.
There's another case of somebody not feeling well.
Yep. At 6 a.m., the hunters awoke and found Raymond gone. Now, they're in the middle of nowhere, and they count the horses. All the horses are there. No supplies were gone, and they couldn't find any tracks leaving the camp. They searched for 6 hours until one of the hunters said, hey, we got to go get RCMP. So he rode out. A day later, they came back with two RCMP police officers and two dogs and handlers and a search and rescue expert. The RCMP interviewed the other hunters. They stated that the night before Raymond vanished, he seemed to be suffering from confusion and something affected his ability, this is the words, to process things normally. The canines could never pick up a scent, and trackers never found his tracks leaving the area. Now, the many hunters I have documented in my other books have also reported being ill after being separated from the party and vanished. So the point of separation here, they all went to their individual tents. A one-week search, they never found Raymond. He had no medical issues. He was of German heritage, and that point of separation.
This is bizarre. I mean, of course, the British Columbia area is a big area, and it's conceivable people are disappearing all over the place, not just around the Vancouver area, right?
Well, there's a case that I'll talk to you about in the Northwest Territories, and that's an area just above Alberta. And if you can ever get a chance to go there, George, it is absolutely phenomenally beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous country, yeah.
So there's a guy named Fred Van Dufflin, 26 years old, raised in Ottawa, had a brother employed in Yellowknife. And Fred and Michael were raised with a deep appreciation of the outdoors. Fred was living in a small town on Victoria Island in the Northwest Territory. He ran a small co-op handicraft store. On December 17th at 4 a.m., Fred left town with his .243 Magnum rifle and a .22 rifle. He told family and friends that he was going to drive the snowmobiles out to an area to go hunting, which was really common in this area. And it's mostly dark in the summer months that far north. On 12/19, Fred had told others he'd be back in a day. He hadn't returned, so the community went out looking for him. And these small communities in the territories that far north, they really look after each other. Well, this has happened to Fred before, and the people knew his hunting grounds, and so they headed for it. Well, Fred had a friend that was going to go with him that had backed out at the last minute. But Fred was traveling a well-known snowmobile route that people had used to hunt. His brother stated he was only going 10 miles out of town to hunt, but there was a lot of discrepancy about those facts. And instead, 30 miles north of Holman, the RCMP found Fred's snowmobile and a mug sitting on it. They located both of his rifles and survival gear.
Jeez.
The sled was held up by a piece of lumber that Fred had been sleeping under on a foam mattress that he had brought. They also located a second snow machine that Fred had taken in case the first one broke down. Now, he's in the middle of nowhere, George. Snow everywhere. He was looking for caribou. The search was started from close to the snow machine with long poles prodding the ground and the RCMP putting two aircraft into the air. This was called the Great Arctic Mystery because nobody knew why Fred would leave this little camp he had that was safe. They didn't find any tracks leaving the area, nothing. Formal search ended January 4th, but Inuit locals and friends searched the following summer and spring looking for a body, clothing, or anything to say where Fred may have gone. Nothing was ever found. And the questions I pose on this, why would Fred leave his camp?
That's not normal to do that.
No. And if there was polar bear predation, there'd be blood and remains everywhere.
Yep.
It's obvious Fred set up a camp there and spent at least one night, as he had claimed he'd spend one night. And in the summation, something must have happened between the time he woke up in that morning and closely thereafter because his drinking and his mug were sitting on top of that snowmobile on top of the bed that he had slept on.
That was weird, too. Stay with us, David. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and take phone calls, promised phone calls, in just a moment. David Politis with us, Missing 411 Canada. Amazing research, David. Truly remarkable. David's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, Dr. Michael Sala joins us as we talk about the U.S. secret space program and other strange things, Project Looking Glass as well. When we come back in a moment with David Politis and his work, Missing 411 Canada, we'll take some phone calls. We're getting lots of calls from Vancouver, British Columbia. We'll get to those calls as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with David Politis, Missing 411 Canada. Let's go to the phones. Let's start with Robert in Vancouver, British Columbia. Robert, you're right out there. Go ahead.
Hi, absolute pleasure to talk to you. This is my dream phone call. I live in Vancouver. I spent the last 4 years exploring these mountains, looking for the types of energies that are behind, you know, disappearances.
Okay.
I've been on these mountains hundreds of times, and I want to share a story that I'm totally excited here that I had of an event. I think that'll give a different viewpoint.
Sure.
Of,
go ahead.
You know, so this would have been, just to stress too, like the access to these mountains are very limited. Like, people don't go up Seymour and then go off the trail. It's, like, so dense. And then when you go into the backcountry on the roads, you know, these are deep valleys. And there's one, two roads, you know, access points. So, you know, it's not easy for anyone to just escape or get away. The roads deteriorate fast. So to be able to get into the backcountry, you need a good 4x4 and be able to get there. So I had gone out, I developed a friendship with some of the elders in the Native community. But I went out on a river pretty deep into that area. It probably be about 15 kilometers straight north of Mount Seymour. I set up camp in an area that is historically known within the Native community as an energy area.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I won't delve into this, but the very first I saw a bunch of lights. I'm going to leave that alone because I was told that that protected me at the end of the day. So I set up camp and I followed Dave's advice. I have the emergency beacon, firearms. I was on a riverbank, and I'm very particular how I set my camp up. I don't have a dark camp. I put Coleman lanterns out on the perimeter, and I've got even further lights out that I can flick on. They're probably about 30, 40 feet out.
That's probably pretty smart, too, Robert.
Yeah, I can flick on with a remote control. Then I've got emergency bundles of fire to throw on the fire and everything. So anyway, these lights came. They felt good. They did, you know, and they disappeared. And I was sitting there contemplating it. And then all of a sudden, I felt this pressure darkness just come down on me. Like, I almost kind of felt like, you know, like if you're fainting, that, you know, your outside vision gets dark. And I've been in this environment many times. I've experienced that darkness in the backwoods. And I instantly was in, like, my heart just raced instantly in a panic. And I set my camp up a particular way. I have a specialized 4x4. I jumped faster than I ever imagined to the back of my van. I grabbed the shotgun, closed the door, and I went to the side door of the, which was always my plan, of the van with my gun ready to jump back in. And there was this crashing noise coming down through the forest, and it just sounded like trees snapping, crashing, breaking. And it got to a point and it stopped, and it sounded like it was 10 feet away, and it was just absolutely so loud. So I just managed to take a few breaths and look around, and you know, I couldn't really hear the river anymore. This amazing crashing and breaking.
Did you pick up camp and get out of there, or what'd you do?
Well, I couldn't get out. I was set up camp. It was in the way of the road. And as I said, I mean, you know, in those roads, you're lucky to cover, when you're that far deep, you're lucky to get 5 miles in an hour. You're not getting out of there fast.
All right, right, David, let's bring you in for a second. Could this have been the beginning of something where he might have gotten taken or disappeared?
So in my movie, Missing 411, The Hunted, I talked about something very similar happening in a Sierra camp to a guy named Ron Moorhead. And it was a group of hunters that had gone to the specific area in the Sierras for 40 years. And they had seen lights. They had heard crashing in the woods. They heard all of this stuff. And they got smart. And a couple of years after they first heard it, they heard some strange things as well. And they put some recorders out there and they recorded it. So, but I've probably heard this from 25 or 30 different hunters in the last
five years. We got another call in Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Rio's with us. Hi, Rio. Good morning.
Hi. I'm wondering if people ever disappear from their homes, or is it always wilderness, or could it ever be like a small park?
David?
So I have written about people who have disappeared from their homes. Now, there's a couple of stories I've written about small boys, one particular where he was in his house with his aunt. His aunt turned the alarm on, and they were sleeping in the family room with their dog. She woke up in 20 minutes when her phone rang. The alarm was still on, and the boy and the dog were gone.
Gone.
Neither was ever found. There's also other stories where homes deep in the woods, goes back to this not feeling well. Boyfriend, girlfriend in their 20s, he went to bed, he wasn't feeling well. In the middle of the night, she woke up, he was gone, he was never found, and this was way up in the woods. So not uncommon.
Regardless of what's happening to these people, David, can you imagine the horror that they are going through moments before this all happens to them? Because they probably see something or witness something or God knows what, but just what they went through, the horror and anxiety, that, oh my God, I just can't feel it.
I can't speak to that, but I can speak to the many families of the missing and the horror they're going through.
Oh, my God. The unknown. It's the worst. Not knowing.
It's the worst. Yeah. And, you know, it lasts a lifetime. And that's something. When imagine losing a small child on a trail. The guilt that you'd have, even if it wasn't your fault.
Let's go to first-time caller Alicia in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Alicia.
I know you've read about this.
Oh, I have.
That there's...
You there? Turn your radio down.
Hello?
Yep, turn your radio down.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, you're on with us now.
Oh, awesome. Okay, let me move into another room so my dad can hear me on the radio.
Okay, we'll let you do that. But do it quickly.
Thank you, George.
Okay.
Dad, let me put this on record for you, Dad. Hold on.
Come on now, Alicia, this is live radio.
Just hold the phone next to the radio, Dad. I'm going to move. Hello.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. David.
He's with us.
Hi. So me and my father have read most of your books, and we feel like it's something that flies.
What do you mean by that, Alicia? Like a big bird or something?
Well, actually, yes. Exactly that, a big bird. Let me tell you why.
All right.
Number one, there's the instance of the dogs not being able to track to a certain point.
Good point.
And number two, by water.
All right.
Number three, there is a serious instance. And me and my father have read a lot of your books, Mr. David. Actually, we own several of them. And we notice a certain mysterious thing where people end up miles uphill.
All right. All of this makes a little sense, David. What do you think of a Thunderbird-type pterodactyl swooping down, picking up people, and flying away?
So I've heard this dozens and dozens of times, and people have to think through this rationally, George. If something's going to grab a small child, because that's the only thing really that's...
The kid will scream.
They're going to scream, and they're going to have these giant talon marks in their shoulders, neck, arms. They're going to have injuries from being gripped like that and picked up. And never has that been reported.
That's the thing. That's what's so puzzling about all this. People don't hear any. One of these birds, you would hear them, you know, crackling and stuff like that. They just don't do it. Interesting theory, Alicia, but it's weird. Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Go ahead, Frank.
Howdy, George. All right, I want both of you to contemplate. Let your mind run away with itself. Invisibility capability, a creature or presence that can snatch a child while the mother or father his back is turned and disappear with it. The dogs can't trace something that is out of this world in another realm.
Right.
And and something I forgot to tell you the other night when we discussed Bigfoot. Is it possible, is it one chance in a billion that Bigfoot could be immortal? By immortal, I mean you can be killed, but you can't die of natural cause.
There are some that believe Bigfoot is coming from another dimension. Some people believe that.
But what about the invisibility? What do you think? Invisibility capable creature.
Almost like those movies.
It's invisible, too.
What do you think about the invisibility of some of these creatures, David?
So I have people from the technology world that talk to me that are way smarter than me that explain to me that this invisibility is reality right now. There's cloth and there's substance out there right now that you can put in front of you that you could carry and make yourself invisible. There was a book written a couple years ago. I read books all the time because I'm trying to always put this together. The book was called Chameleo, Chameleo, and it was about a family that was being bothered in the San Diego area. And the bottom line was, is it all kind of pointed to naval intelligence doing some kind of work with invisibility and being caught at it. And so I think our government has that ability, and they do. If you just go online, there's several companies in the technology sector that are working with invisibility cloaking technology right now.
That could be fantastic and strange. Brian in Indianapolis. Hey, Bri.
Hey, George. Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Hey, great topic. Hey, David, I got an interesting question on this. Have you ever checked the phases of the moon during any of these disappearances? And what about maybe the Earth's magnetic field also having effect on the people and that are feeling ill, and the Earth or the moon cycle combining with the magnetic field of the Earth, you know, the Earth's magnetic field? George, I'll take my answer off the air. You guys do a great job.
All right, Brian. What about the possibility of some kind of electronic magnetic field that's causing them to be sick or something, David?
Well, you'd think that if there was some type of field in the area, that it would affect the others in the area as well.
That's a good point. It wouldn't just single one person out.
Right, and that isn't the case. So, and the large percentage, I would say probably 90% or more, have disappeared during the day. The most common time for a disappearance is 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, so it's not just nighttime.
No.
Linda's in Bloomington, Illinois. We'll get you in here real fast. Linda, go ahead.
Thanks, George. I just love this show.
Thank you, dear.
You and Tommy do a fantastic job. I got a couple questions here. One, has he ever tallied up to see, in all the time that he's been doing this, how many people actually have come missing that they've never been found? And number two, they've been telling this on the news here lately. There's a woman here in Illinois, and she's 53 years old, that drives a purple car, and she's never missed a day of work, and she left to go to work in the morning, and no one has seen or heard from her since. And that took place September 25th. They have no idea what happened to this woman.
Did they ever find the car?
Nope.
That's weird, too. But, David, what about total people? What is your research showing so far?
So people have to remember that I don't research all missing people. Even all.
No, you told us how you rule some of them out.
Right. So it's a very small segment of the total missing person. Even people who go to the woods, if they don't fit this narrow band of that we require, we won't look at it. So when you look at the totality, who knows? And who knows, because the Park Service tells us they don't keep lists of missing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All we know is that the missing people that you investigate, it's still a high, strange number, isn't it?
Oh, it's very high, I think. Yeah. In fact, in that Vancouver area, just like that man told us, I mean, there's so many that we don't even know about.
David, where can people, one, see the film Missing 411, The Hunted?
Amazon, iTunes. You can buy a DVD from our site and get the books only from our site. Don't buy them on Amazon. You're going to get ripped off. But that's the Can-Am, like C-A-N as in Nora, A-M as in Mary, canammissing.com.
Super. All right. That's a good thing to know. David Politis, one of our most sought-after guests. Up next, Dr. Michael Sala joins us. We're going to be talking about Project Looking Glass.